And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
I was a political consultant for a long time, and one of the people I met early in my years in politics was Mark McKinnon, who was doing the same kind of work. We worked together on Democratic campaigns. He was from Texas, switched sides to work for George W. Bush, and was his chief media strategist in the 2000 and 2004 presidential campaigns, and now a host of The Circus on Showtime, a great documentary series covering what has become a circus, the 2016 presidential campaign. Sat down with Mark during the convention week in Cleveland to talk about where we are now, but also his experiences over a lifetime in politics. I'm sitting with Mark McKinnon, my old buddy, and he's got his hat on, his scarf as well, but the hat, we were just talking about it, it's an Open Road Stetson, is that what it is?
Yeah, this is a Stetson.
Big straw hat.
It's a straw hat, the summer version of the classic felt Stetson.
Is your horse outside or
nearby? There's not a picture of me growing up. I don't have a hat on. I've just always loved hats, and it started with my dad, who did some ranching early on in his career. And
but wait a second, this is what I'm getting at. You grew up in Colorado,
yeah,
did you not?
Yeah, that's where I'm from.
Where in Colorado?
Born in Boulder, and then grew up in Denver and Summit County.
So did a lot of folks wear open road
Stetsons
in Denver and Boulder?
Yeah, they did, and my dad, most importantly. And I remember being like 4 years old and going into his closet, and it was like a dad closet, which had, you know, just cool dad stuff. You know, there was just cool trinkets and stuff and cufflinks and, you know, maybe a rifle or something. But the coolest thing to me on the top shelf was his Stetson. And I remember thinking, I can't wait till I'm old enough to have my own.
All right, well, congratulations, brother. You made it. Tell me about growing up in Colorado.
I love Colorado. I mean,
what'd your dad do?
He was a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
He was a doctor and a great classic country doctor. You know, the kind of guy that, you know, went bankrupt a couple of times because he was always working for free and helping people out. And, you know, we have like tons of art that people would give him instead of money for surgery. He was just one of those great classic docs. And spent a lot of time.
Most of the people in Boulder self-medicated, but that's
well, that's true, and especially up in the mountains where I live now. But the great thing is that I now have a daughter and grandchildren in Colorado, and we've kind of come full circle, and I'm back in the mountains of Colorado, which I love.
And you guys moved to Texas?
Yeah, I was in the music business for a while until I realized that was not the best use of my talent. And
famously hung with Kris Kristofferson.
Well, I got really lucky. When I was in high school, he heard our band and then decided to produce us to try to get us a record deal, which, no surprise if you hear the tapes, didn't work out. But I ran away. I got the bug, and I ran away from home, hitchhiked to Nashville, lived in his apartment for about 3 years, kicked around the music business. That's how I ended up in Austin, Texas. I went to play at the Kerrville Folk Festival in 1975 in Texas and discovered Austin and fell in love with Austin. And that's how I got there. And then did that for a while, but on the arc that I was on, I realized I was going to end up as like the second act at the Pflugerville Holiday Inn when I was 50 years old, and I said, it's time to go to Plan B.
Yeah, you didn't want to do the try the veal thing?
No.
So talk about Plan B.
Well, part of the reason I love songwriting is I've always loved storytelling, and I loved writing. I always loved writing, like you. And the reason I liked music was the songwriting part of the business.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, and country music, that's all it is.
It's
all storytelling.
Exactly right. And Kris Kristofferson was one of the best storytellers of.
Did you, by the way, did you work on songs with him?
Absolutely not. I mean, the last thing Kris Kristofferson needed was any help from anybody, especially me. No, he was just really a great mentor, and, you know, let me live in his apartment and kick around the publishing
house. He's still around,
house.
Right?
He is. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you keep in touch with him?
Yeah, I do. I saw him about a year ago when he came to Austin, and he's doing well. But, you know, he's having some issues with from his boxing days, you know, and lots of concussions, so he's starting to...
I saw the other day, I was scanning through TV, I saw an old tape of The Highwaymen.
Oh, yeah, boy, what
Johnny,
a classic
Johnny
group.
Cash and Willie Graham Nelson,
Jennings.
Waylon Jennings, and Kris Kristofferson was like the young guy in the group.
I know, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a cool group of dudes.
So anyway, back to you. So you, plan B.
Yeah, well, I was there in Austin, Texas, and there was this big university, and I had always said I'd try a little higher education, so I did that, and very quickly migrated to the Daily Texan, which is the newspaper there at the University of Texas, and then I love to write, and so I wrote a lot, and I wrote a lot about politics because I love politics, so I started writing about politics.
Why did you love politics?
Just always had. I mean, just always been passionate about...
Were your folks?
Not particularly, but... You know, I was a child of the 60s, and it was hard to grow up in the 60s without being somewhat political.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, just barely missed getting drafted. And just was surrounded by all that. And then there was a local state senator in Austin named Lloyd Doggett who decided to...
I had Begala on a few weeks ago, so
we talked
about that campaign.
So Paul and I have a lot of history, and a lot of people have a lot of history with that campaign. It was a kind of a seminal campaign for a lot of people who are still in the business today. Steve Domenico and... You know, lots of people that you know.
Oh, well, James Carville.
Carville, yeah. Yeah. It was really I went to volunteer for that campaign. I just thought, you know, this is interesting.
Was Kiki Moore in there?
Yes, Kiki was there. Yeah, sure, yeah.
A lot of great...
Linda.
A whole...
Linda Moore was there.
Yeah, a whole generation of...
A whole generation, yeah.
We had another campaign that the same year, which was 84.
Uh-huh.
I was doing the Paul Simon campaign in Illinois. Begala and I were talking about this, and you know, Rahm Emanuel was a young field guy, and bunch of people.
My
went
counterpart
on to do...
in that campaign on the Republican side was John Weaver.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Famously now, John Kasich's alter ego.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I went over there, and you know, I'd never worked on a political campaign, but I just wanted to volunteer and was happy to do that. Did that for a week or two, and then I saw a sign down in the basement that said, you know, looking for people to do data input for $5 an hour, and that was like a lot more money than I'd ever made. And I said, great, I'll do that. Did that for a couple of weeks, and I was in the basement, and then one day Begala walked down to the basement and goes, hey, McKinnon's down here. This guy can do some press. So they floated me up to the press office, and then I started doing press. And then I just completely got the bug. And this is also, I mean, it was a great classic campaign. We won the big upset primary, and then we got crushed in the general. It was Reagan year.
Yes.
And then I thought, well, that's the end of my political career. And then this is when I discovered you can fail upward in politics. And I got a call from the governor's office the next week saying, come on over.
You, Doggett actually is still around, too.
He is. He's still in Congress.
Everybody involved in that campaign is still around and
which is,
and
like
doing
I said
stuff.
About politics, you can fail upwards.
So who was the governor then? Was it Mark White?
Yeah.
And what did you do for him?
I was a press assistant in the press office of the governor's office, and then I went over and was the press secretary for his campaign. And that's when I started working with people like Ray Strother and David Sawyer.
Two great classic
consultants, kind of the giants of our business,
yeah.
And then I said, that's what I want to do. I really thought that was cool. And then I was going to...
Did they work with White?
Right. They worked with White. And then I said, that married up all my interests, you know, writing, you know, television, storytelling.
Yeah. This is, you know, we have parallel stories because, you know, Bob Squire was the media consultant, another one of the giants of early...
Well, Squire and Sawyer were really the pioneers. In fact, there was a book written about them called Alpha Dogs. I don't know if you've read that, but you should if you haven't, because that book details... the evolution of the export of American-style campaigns, and it's really interesting. And it's written by like a legitimate Wall Street Journal reporter, so it's got a critical view of it too.
Yeah.
It's not just some hagiography of those guys.
Those guys were great characters.
They were great characters. I could tell stories about them all day.
What did so you went to work for Strother?
No, what happened is Raymond offered me a job, but I had a couple of different options. One, by the way, was Dick Morris called me and asked me if I wanted to go to work for a governor in Arkansas named Bill Clinton, and I got on a conference call with Dick Morris and Betsy Wright to talk about that.
My goodness, yeah.
Gary Morrow.
And what happened?
The land commissioner. What happened was I talked to somebody who I really admired and respected, and they said, if you think you know anything about politics, go to Louisiana and get your Ph.D.
Mm-hmm.
So I talked to Raymond all those days. I said, I'd love to do it, but I need
to... He was from Louisiana, right?
Yes, yeah. In fact, when I told him, he said, I completely endorse that, and it's true. And by God, it was. That was by far my favorite year in politics. And I learned more that year than I have the rest of my life.
Working for Buddy Romer?
Working for Buddy Romer, who was a, you know, barely mentioned in most of the stories about that race early on. He was a congressman from Northeast Louisiana. Nobody ever wins from Northeast Louisiana because it's lightly populated. And we were running against Edwin Edwards.
Yeah.
You know, the greatest candidate. He'd won 19 elections in a row.
Yes, and then he served a term elsewhere, but at the request of the federal government.
Yeah, and here's the classic why it's so colorful in Louisiana. I'm working for Buddy Romer, who's this reformer running against Edwin Edwards, whose former chief of staff, Buddy Romer's father, was in prison at the time.
Yeah, that's Louisiana.
Woo!
Yeah.
That's some great stuff. I mean, that's some Robert Penn Warren shit right there.
Yeah. My favorite Edwin Edwards story was when he was running against David Treen, the Republican governor, who was kind of a prim guy. And they said to him, Treen says, if you get elected, you're going to steal everything. And he said, if Treen is there for four more years, there won't be anything left to steal.
And I think it was Treen about Edwards said, it takes him an hour and a half to watch 60 Minutes.
Yeah, Edwards was...
He was so good. I mean, you know, we talk about politicians and what's compelling today, and you look at what works and what doesn't, and what people really are hungry for today is authenticity. That's the kind of thing Edwards had. I mean, he was like, people knew that he stole and he cheated, but he was candid about it. He said, I do, but I steal for you.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's sort of the Louisiana tradition, you know. I mean, Huey Long and all of that. Yeah. So, but Romer did a great ad in that campaign.
It was a Ray Struther ad. I think it's one of the greatest.
One of the classic
ads of all time.
Yeah. To talk about that.
Well, Buddy Romer was just, the reason he was so compelling was that he was a great mix of Louisiana raconteur. He was a big poker player and reported his poker earnings during Congress. But he also went to, here's the trick, you know, he does all this kind of the James Carville thing, this, you know, shticking thing. But then it turns out he went to Harvard at 16 and then got his MBA at Harvard at 18. You know, super smart.
Yeah.
And but we were, in fact, I remember one point in the campaign, we were so broke that we had a press idea that we had $50,000 left in the campaign, and we decided that we'd go to Las Vegas and put it all on red. And we'd either, you know, go broke or keep the campaign going.
Did you do it?
No, we didn't.
Yeah. We didn't. But the Romer ad.
Oh, I'm sorry. Romer ad. The great thing about, you and I both know that, you know, the most boring thing you can do in politics is a talking head ad. Well, this contradicts that, because this guy on camera was so compelling, lit it up. But his basic message was that it was kind of this reform message before there were reformers, you know,
right.
And especially in Louisiana. But the last line was one that I loved. I mean, he said, I'm going to take on, you know, I'm going to, you know, burn down the Department of Education.
Yeah,
I'm going to
do this.
But the last line, which was so great, he said, I love Louisiana. I love Louisiana enough to make some people angry.
Yeah. Yeah, he said, I know I've made people angry.
And he was, the thing I loved about him was he was a great example. You know, so many politicians that we work for want to make everybody happy. Romer understood the value of stepping on some big toes, you know, and make it clear that I'm willing to take out some people.
Yeah.
You know, I believe strongly enough that I'm going to take some pain.
Yeah, well, that ad was one that I really studied closely when I started out because, yes, it was the thing that made it work was it was utterly authentic. His passion was clear.
Yeah.
He said things that other people weren't willing to say, and it really cut through. So you went out on your own and started doing ads.
I did. At first, I went to New York, and I worked for David Sawyer, who was Bob Squire's counterpart, and one of the real godfathers of the business. And the thing that was great for me was that, you know, he was older, and at that point, you know, he didn't want to be running around the world. But he and Bob Squire, like I said, had started, like, exporting American-style democracy. So I got to do campaigns in South America and Africa, and, you know, he'd get hired and then send me to go do the work. So I really got thrown in the deep end fast, and it was a great way to learn. And then I did that for a while. And
was
then
Mandy Grunwald there?
Worked side by
now
side with Mandy.
With Hillary Clinton, has been for years.
Yeah, and,
very,
you know,
very, very smart lady.
Well, super smart. And, you know, and I sat side by side with her, and she was an awesome talent then, is an awesome talent now, and I learned a lot from her, too.
Yeah. So then you went out on your own.
I did, yeah. Then I had this, one of the other greats of our business is a guy named Roy Spence from Texas.
Yeah.
And Roy had done politics for a long time. He's done a lot of work with Bill Clinton. and Hillary Clinton.
Yes, and still I think you're still in touch with them.
Very much a consigliere and close friend, and one of the great, great talents and great people in the business. But he's decided that he was going to get out of the political business at the time, just go completely commercial. And then I just saw an opening then and said, there's room for another ad guy down in Texas. So I went and set up shop down in Texas.
And you and I met in 1991 working for a guy named Bob Lanier in Houston, Texas, who was really one of the most interesting guys that I've ever worked for.
He really was. In so many ways, that was such an interesting campaign.
Running for mayor.
He was running for mayor, and this was a guy who was old, white, rich. And this is the sort of thing where people like you and I kind of sit down with him early on the campaign, and he says something like, I'm thinking about running for mayor, and we look at the data, and we kind of go, you might want to rethink this, because it's like everything that voters hated, he was. A real estate guy, a banker, a lawyer. You know, just not compelling in any way on paper. But beyond the paper, he was a real, live, deep human being who cared passionately about city, and sort of in the old style of, like, he was a citizen who just wanted to give something back.
And his big issue, and he looked at the city budget like a balance sheet.
He was a mainframe computer in his head. Yeah.
He wanted to take money from a transit system the mayor wanted to build and put it into more police on the streets.
Yeah, and people were really concerned about
crime
and safety at that point. And this was a classic example of, you know, people saying, well, you know, Article 3 of City Rule 4 says you can't do that. And he says, elect me and watch me.
Yeah, he did it. The reason we got to know each other so well, first of all, he was so rich that he could afford two media consultants.
Yeah, he did a Noah's Ark of consultants. Yes. He like just had two of everybody.
And we all stayed on the third floor of his mansion.
Yeah, and we
Houston.
Lived with him. That's how he was a super confident guy, but he didn't know politics. So if I hire you guys, you got to live with me. And
yeah.
we did.
Yeah, yeah.
But one of my favorite stories from that campaign was, you know, in a classic budget meeting of the campaign, we're all in there. We're all arguing for our little piece of the pie. I'm like, no, we need, 10,000 more for media. And the mail guy saying, well, no, we need 20 for mail. And we need, street money. And we're having this big argument. And Lanier, who was 6'4 and had like size 15 boots and a big cigar, was in the back of the room. And he leans back. And I remember just hearing his booming voice going, boys, quit. So Lanier leans back. And he says, boys, just spend it till you waste it.
Yeah, those are good clients to have. That's a useful thing.
Yeah.
But he ended
and
up...
By the way, we needed every bit of brain power to win that election.
Yeah,
as
you remember, brain power and more.
Yeah, and some luck.
Yeah.
Remember, wild developments. But that guy is now mayor of Houston, Sylvester Turner.
Yeah, yeah.
The guy we beat.
He was talented.
Super talented.
Ran into some trouble at the end. That turned out... A little bit of a scandal that turned out in his favor at the end of the day. Didn't he win a lawsuit on this?
Yeah, he did. Yeah, he did. He won a libel lawsuit against the television station.
Yeah, yeah. Sometime after you and I worked together on that Lanier campaign, and in Texas, the lines were always a little blurry between Democrats and Republicans.
Well, not just blurry. I mean, it's hard for people to remember back that far, but it's really not that ancient history. But like in 1990, I worked with Ann Richards, ran for governor, and she won. There's 28 constitutional statewide offices in Texas. In 1990, every single one of them was a Democrat. In 2008, 8 years later, every single one of them was a Republican. There was no Republican Party in Texas for the longest time. You were either a conservative Democrat or a Democrat. You were a Lloyd Benson Democrat or you were a Ralph Yarborough Democrat.
Right.
So there really wasn't an alternative. If you were there, you were a Democrat. And I just, the evolution happened right as I was getting older. I was having family. I was, there were some issues.
Working for Public Strategies at that point, right?
Yeah, working for a company that we started called Public Strategies.
That did corporate work.
Did corporate work and public affairs. And so I was kind of focused on that. But I was also very close to the lieutenant governor of Texas named Bob Bullock, mm-hmm. who was a legendary character. And Bob Bullock became a mentor to George W. Bush, and they became very close friends. And they governed in a way in Texas that, we all wish.
Lieutenant governor is very powerful in Texas.
Super powerful, yeah, really more powerful than the governor. And they showed what it's like when you have real bipartisan leadership. And
we should explain more powerful because they basically run the state Senate, right?
They run the state Senate and, have all kinds of executive authority. And the governor has limited powers, but... Anyway, they became very close, so close that when Bush ran for re-election, Bullock, the Democrat, endorsed Bush over his godson, Gary Morrow, who ran against Bush. But
awkward.
just a little. And so in the middle of that, I had gotten to know George Bush. I was doing a, I had gotten excited about charter schools, and I was doing a, I'd done a kind of a film thing about charter schools, and so I had a meeting with him, showed him the film. He got excited about charter schools too, and then we got to know each other just on a social level, and he had girls just about my girl's age, two girls, I had two girls. He liked to run, I liked to run. We started running together and just, you know, and biking, and then in the middle of all that, his media guy at the time got into some legal trouble and had to bail out, and so Bob Bullock and Karl Rove and some others kind of got together and said, you know, what? Why don't we have McKinnon do this? And so,
have any reluctance at all?
Yeah, sure. I mean, well, it was a very difficult decision. It took me months to make it, and I thought long and hard about it. But I had at that time, just ideologically. I mean, I've always been kind of in the middle somewhere. I was a little left of center early on in my life, but I'd kind of grown more conservative, and it was kind of a radical free trader, and you know, just on some issues, had just been kind of drifting more conservative, and then. The most powerful thing was that George Bush came along with this message about compassionate conservatism. And this is, again, amazing to think about now, but one of the big messages that he was talking about at the time that really attracted me was his pro-immigration message.
Mm-hmm.
He was embraced it full-throated. I mean, he was a big-time immigration supporter. And that was a big issue in our campaign in 19. I remember some advisors in 1999 saying, you should be careful about this issue. And he said, oh, no, I don't care what you think.
Well, an interesting sidelight to that, I was doing the campaign for John Sharp in 1998, who was running for lieutenant governor against Rick Perry.
Yeah.
And Sharp lost by a point and a half. And the margin of defeat was the fact that. The turnout in the Hispanic areas was so low, primarily because people were satisfied with George Bush.
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
you know, there was no impetus to come out and vote for Democrats.
That's so interesting.
And that was largely a reflection of Bush's position on immigration.
Yeah, so he was, I was really attracted to that idea and that message, and so I crossed the bridge, and... You know, with the exception of a few rifle shots, most people, including people like Paul Begala, came out and publicly said, "Listen, I know McKinnon. I trust that this is I trust his motive here, that it's pure and
of course
not some calculated political
move." You could
move.
Steal a car, and Begala would come to your defense because he's ultimately loyal.
Well, that's because I got all the secrets on Begala.
He would say the same about you.
Well, it's true.
So you went and you worked for Bush. Talk about Bush as a person.
Well, as I said, I sort of got to know him personally before I got to know him professionally, and he's one of the people you meet, not just in politics, but in life, that is so engaging and so authentic, so fun, you know, and also a real moral clarity about the guy. This was a guy that you meet, and you just, you know, he kind of... sees life in sort of black and white in terms of values, you know, about honesty and family. And I initially sort of, in a way, he was kind of a mentor to me in the sense of like being a father and a citizen. You know, I kind of looked at him and I'd just been, you know, running around doing my business and stuff. And he kind of caught my attention. It's like, you know, you need to start thinking about how you live your life.
Well,
you know,
he
not
had
just
done some deep
do.
Thinking about how he lived his life.
Yeah,
right? He went through some dissolute times.
Big time, big time. Yeah. And so that caught my attention. And then, he had a real clarity of vision and what he believed. And so I love that politically. But the other thing about him is that, you know, we talk about these, you know, this is the classic focus group story. You know, the people that we ran against, we were blessed by our opposition in both 2000 and 2004 in the sense that even if people disagreed with George Bush politically, they saw him as an authentic...
See,
kind of character.
So
we go through these focus groups, and people say, "I disagree with him on this. I disagree with him on that. I disagree with him on that." And in the end, you'd say, "Well, if you had an opportunity to go have a beer with Al Gore or George Bush, unanimous George Bush."
Right. Yeah. No, I think this is. I really do think authenticity is a leading indicator in presidential races. I think people want someone who they
especially
think is comfortable
now,
in their own skin.
You know, David, when I first got the job to do Bush's media, I was honored but petrified because I'd never done anything on that scale, and it scared the hell out of me. It was a huge responsibility. So the first thing I did was I went back and did a bunch of due diligence and studied political advertising, presidential political advertising, from the very beginning, and studied it to see what it, you know, what worked, what didn't. And it was fascinating. I used to have a long presentation about that, because you see it change and evolve over time. Because as voters get used to something, you know, it's like a virus or something. You know, you inoculate it and then you try something new. So you see, you know, high concept stuff for a while works, and it kind of moves along those axes. But what I really saw happen recently, I say recently, the last 10 years, and with George W. Bush, is that power of authenticity. Because, as you know, political advertising these days, you know, is minimally effective because people just don't believe it. They say it's a, you know, you got the First Amendment, you can say whatever you want, and all politicians lie. So,
well,
why
and there's
should
so
I
much of it
saying?
Too. Yeah. What with the proliferation, Citizens United, and the proliferation of ads.
Right.
And,
so,
but I think the old constructs of political advertising are people. It's like antibiotics. People have, you know.
That's the word I was looking for. You know, antibiotics. That's perfect.
Yeah, people have developed.
Well, so I did things with Bush that were. I almost never did anything that was scripted. It was always something, you know, just pulled from an interview or off of the trail. But here's an example. So we're shooting the classic biofilm for the convention. This is, you know, your candidate gets introduced. A lot of people are going to see him. So there's the classic thing where you produce a biofilm, you know, a 10-minute film.
Yeah, sure.
Which you've done many of. And so we're shooting it. And we're interviewing then Governor Bush and Laura Bush, and he's talking about being in the delivery room when their twins were born, and he's talking about it, and he completely mangles what he was trying to say, just garbles it completely, and he and Laura laugh about it, and we say, okay, that was funny, okay, back up, let's do it again. We do like two or three takes till he gets it just right. Well, I get to the edit room to edit the film, and that moment comes up, and we start to cut it and get the good one patched in, and I said, well, wait a minute, let's watch that again, and we all cracked up. I said, let's leave it. and you can imagine the campaign, they went batshit.
Yeah.
It's like, you were going to leave a mistake in the film? And I said, listen, it's authentic, it's human, it's funny, people can relate. And by the way, let's not raise the bar of expectations on this guy. You know? I mean, he's not going to be the best orator, speech giver in presidential
which
history.
Which he's pretty open about.
Yeah. Yeah, he is. And so let's just be authentic about this and say he is who he is. And you know, and then so we did leave it, and it really worked.
You know, when Rich Daley ran for mayor of Chicago in 1989, and I worked for him, you know, he had lost in '83. There was this; he still was viewed by many people as kind of the not as smart sort of knockoff of his dad. Mm-hmm. He didn't. He like his dad didn't. You know, English didn't seem like it came naturally to
not
him.
Not a first language.
And so, you know, we did an introductory ad in which he said, it was direct to camera kind of thing, he said, I may not be the best speaker in town, but I know how to run a government and how to bring people together, and that's what we need now. Just the admission that, you know, I know what you guys think, and you're right, you know, I'm not, it was disarming.
It goes a long way.
It was
disarming. It goes a long way. I mean, that candor. And also, by the way, just people today, you know, they're suspicious of perfection. They actually like a little bit of vulnerability, some human element to say that this is actually a real person.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, I think, you know, somehow reflecting some moments of vulnerability can actually help a campaign.
Speaking of moments of vulnerability, you told me a story about what happened, and I had parallel stories with Obama. What happened when you guys got blown out in New Hampshire by John McCain in 2000? And, you know, you were really on the ropes there. And you told me that you walked into a meeting with Bush, and you honestly didn't know the day after that primary whether everybody was going to be asked to leave.
Oh, not only did we not. I mean, I remember it was with Stuart Stevens, who just did the Romney campaign. And we were in our apartment. We were at lunch with a journalist, with Karl Rove, Stuart and I, and we got the news. And Stuart immediately said, let's go pack because we're fired. As he said, I've been in this movie before. We're gone. We went and we got a call to come over to visit with Governor Bush, and you know the sort of senior staff went over there, and we walked in just, you know, prepared to get our asses kicked, and it was so powerful and so completely contradictory to what we expected, because we walked in and he said, I got a message for you guys. This is on me. You guys did a great job. I let you down. I'm sorry. He said, but when we walk out of here, heads held high. I want to walk out here looking like we just won, you know, the best victory we've ever won. And that's when you, that's when we all said, man, sign me up for life.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have a completely...
And Peggy Noonan, by the way, wrote a piece about his speech that night and said, if you turned off the sound, you would have thought that was a victory speech.
Had the same experiences with Obama when he lost New Hampshire, and he was supposed to win New Hampshire to Hillary Clinton. And more than that, he was Texas and Ohio in 2008. The notion was if we had won those two, that she was done.
Right.
And we lost them both. And he said, I want to see everybody tomorrow. So we go in. We don't know, same as you. And he walks in and he says, you know, I can think of 12 things I could have done better in the last 2 weeks. And I bet everybody in this room could, too. He said, so I'm not here to talk about that. I want to figure out what, where we go from here and what we learn from this. And we had this two-hour discussion. At the end of it, he's walking out of the room and he turns around and he says, look, I'm not yelling at you guys. I want you to understand that. And then he said, takes another couple of steps and turns around and says, of course, after blowing $20 million in 2 weeks, he said, I could yell at you. He says, but I'm not yelling at you. And he laughed and walked out of the room.
Great.
And you know what? Everybody in that room would have run through a wall for him.
Exactly.
But I actually think campaigns are tests of how these guys are going to handle pressure.
Adversity. You know? The adversity test is where you really see leadership. I had another thing. I was going to just a parallel story that I thought was funny because I think I remember calling you when it happened, which is, the first debate of an incumbent president.
Oh, my.
You know, because it's just so, the dynamics of debates are, so, by the way, I think this first debate of this fall may be the most watched television event.
I agree with
history.
You. I think this whole thing, first of all, as we can both testify,
it's like the highest wire act in politics,
yeah.
Right? I mean, because your guy goes out there without a net.
Yeah.
And man, it is big time tension city.
Oh, my God.
Right?
Yeah.
But the funny thing that happens with an incumbent president is they've been a president for 4 years. They're used to a lot of people saying yes, sir.
Yeah, nobody getting in their grill.
Nobody getting in their grill. They're feeling pretty bulletproof.
Yeah.
The last thing they want to do is go debate.
Yeah.
They don't want to debate this jokester that's been out here going through, you know.
Yeah.
You know, they,
well, they don't think belongs there.
Doesn't think belongs there.
Yeah.
And I remember we had the classic experience where, President Bush is debating, and it's awful. I mean, it is it is as bad as it could be. But he walks off the stage, and it's like, good, right?
Yeah, I know.
Like,
this is just continues the parallel lives we've left. And by the way, you were always generous. I was the beneficiary of your experiences throughout because I was the next cycles,
yeah.
And you and I.
I think I called you after your first debate. And I said,
yeah.
David, get ready for this. I know what's going to happen.
But you know, I circled that date on the calendar, that first debate in Denver, months in advance in red because I knew what the history of this was. And we tried so hard to get him ready. There was a sense of doom heading to Denver because everybody knew,
yep.
You know. And we went into his locker room, you know, in an arena before the debate. Plouffe and I went in and just to give him the old attaboy kind of thing. And he said, let's just get this over with and get out of here, which is not what you want to hear.
That's classic.
Yeah, but he was really challenged by the second debate. We had a few tense moments prepping for the second debate, too. But when we went in to see him before the second debate, he said, Obama said, we're going to have a good night tonight. And, you know, and he just knew. And he went out and he just, you know, but he needed to get knocked on his butt to perform. On Bush, you ran as compassionate conservatives, and a whole bunch of stuff happened. First of all, you know, I'll give you the sort of progressive critique, but the squandering of the deficits of the surplus on big tax cuts at a time of war, so you end up
also prescription drugs,
right. Right, which you could argue was an act of compassion. But the war itself.
Yes, sir.
Our buddy Matthew Dowd, he was a fellow at my institute, which I hope you will be at some point when you're in hiatus from your television career. Matthew was traumatized by the Iraq war, and his son went off and served and so on, and really split with the president over that. I mean, were there moments there where you had sort of say, well, how do we take this fork in the road here? How did the Bush presidency become about this and so on?
Of course, there was such traumatic, dramatic tragic time in our history. But you know, those decisions were so far beyond my pay grade, and you know, I could only trust that the guy that I knew and had worked for and had been loyal to was making the decisions on the best evidence that he had at the time. And you know, we all know how it turned out, and it wasn't good evidence, and we all, you know, the world has paid a price for that. But I never had a notion. I mean, my counsel. I mean, I, you know, there were times when I didn't agree with the direction, but I offered my counsel and was not always in the majority, but my counsel was always welcome, not always taken, but it's always private. You know, it's not anything that I ever discussed.
You know, every my experience is that, and certainly my experience with this the president that I serve is that presidents get stronger as they go along because they become more experienced, confident.
Sure.
You know, it's natural.
Yeah.
Do you? You know, the interpretation of the story that you always get is he ceded too much early to Cheney, to others, and that he came into his own later in his presidency when he sort of seized control back. Do you think Cheney had too much influence in that administration?
I think the narrative belief about that is distorted. I mean, I think that George Bush was always in charge, but I think he picked a strong number two, knowing that he could exert that kind of authority. But the notion that sort of Dick Cheney was ever kind of, you know, a puppet master, I think it distorts the real picture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember, I mean, early on, you know, I was a McCain man. I thought McCain would have been a great number two for the president. So, you know, Dick Cheney and I were kind of like Venus and Mars. We first introduced us, like, I don't get you, you don't get me, let's just leave it like that.
Uh-huh. So you didn't have much interaction with him.
I probably had, you know, maybe two paragraphs in 8 years.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about this election. You know, we talked about authenticity.
It's a circus out there.
Yes,
David.
It is. And we're going to finish up by talking about this extraordinary production that you're involved in during this campaign. Because I love, you know, we're both storytellers, and the campaigns are odysseys and should be told.
That's
as
why
such.
I wanted to do it, yeah.
Yeah. But let's talk about the odyssey itself. What are your observations, having been on the road, of these two candidates and how people interact and how people are intuiting, you know, their sense of them?
Well, you know,
I should point out before you answer that question, one of the things that I've always been jealous of is that you used to do your own focus groups. And I always wanted, you know, my mom was in qualitative research. I always thought it'd be cool. I love any reporter. I was started as a reporter as well. Loves to ask questions and learn from what people have to say. You're out there on the road now, not just with candidates, but with people. So talk about how you think people are viewing this election.
Well, they're viewing it in such a different way, David. And the thing that got my attention more than anything this election was the first Trump rally that I went to. And, you know, I'd kind of heard things, and I went, and I've been in politics about the same time as you have, which is a long time. I've never seen anything remotely close to what I saw at that first Trump rally. I mean, the people, the energy, the Trump himself was all just blew my mind completely. Now, I have thought for a while that the opening for a conceptual candidate like that, a businessman, outsider. I went back and looked, because I've kind of looked at third-party possibilities and that sort of thing. I went back and looked at the Ross Perot candidacy and looked at the research from that election, like the right track, wrong track, all those sort of fundamentals that we look at. And they were of a nature that made a candidacy like Perot's possible, but you look at those same kind of metrics, flash forward to like 3 years ago or something, it's like times 10. So the notion that somebody like Trump could run, I mean, it was an opening a mile wide, but the fact that it was Trump was what was surprising, and that he would do it by literally doing a hostile takeover of the Republican Party, which is what was so surprising, and that he could mow down a field. But the interesting thing about the election is that, you know, we're used to kind of seeing you know, somewhere, I'd just say in the middle of the kind of scales of insider versus outsider, candidates are somewhere in there, although you had, you know, a sort of classic outsider in a way.
Yes.
But here we have, like, sort of the most extreme possibilities, right, of, like, the ultimate insider, aristocracy kind of royal candidate. And then we have the, you know, on the other end of the extreme, you know, a real estate billionaire who's never held office. And,
right.
And so we just have this interesting situation where we, you know, usually it's somewhere in the middle, and this time it's like just starkly on the spectrum.
And how are people, what do you see at her, around her?
You know, you see...
Meaning Hillary, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, it is a much more subdued, much less emotional, but very committed sort of audiences that, you know, believe in her competency, believe that she's ready, prepared to be president, and then, you know, but not a lot of emotion, you know, and the Trump rallies are just the opposite. I mean, it's pure emotion.
Yeah, but let me ask you this. We're sitting here in Cleveland. We just went through the first night of the Republican convention. It was, you know, if you had high cholesterol, this was not the place to be. This was a total red meat fest.
Yeah.
Other than Melania, and we'll talk about that in a second. My question is, are there enough white voters? Are there enough white voters to win an election in 2016? Your guy, Karl Rove and George Bush, understood that Hispanics were a growing constituency in this country. There was an outreach to minorities. George Bush got 44% of the Hispanic vote in 2000.
Yeah.
And four, and that's one of the reasons why he.
Yeah. Well, interestingly, I mean, and at the end of the day, it is about math. I mean, you got to add up to, you know, 50.1
right.
Somehow, somewhere.
Or whatever you need. There'll be some other candidates on the ballot. But
Right. A plurality enough
right.
to win. So in 2004, well, in 2000, when we ran. Matthew, Dad, we kind of sat down and said, what do we need to do? How do we need to perform with Hispanics? And he said, well, we need 40% of the Hispanic vote in order to win. We got 41. But after we won in 2000, Dowd came in like a month later and he said, you know, before everybody gets all excited about this, we better recognize that if we get 41 next time, we lose.
Right.
We got to get 42 next time, and we got 43.
Right.
So George Bush and the campaign understood that we had to have a coalition and a big tent. Now, you go from that to...
Wall Street Journal poll the other day, Donald Trump 14%
among
Hispanics.
I think McCain got 27, or Romney got around
27. Romney got 27. McCain got in the 30s.
Okay, so 30s, 27. So we're clawing our way to the bottom with Hispanics, and now...
As they're growing as a constituent.
As they're growing, and so I, you know...
Are there enough white votes to replace the votes that he is kicking away?
Well, it's hard to see it on paper. It's really hard to see it. I mean, and even if you do, boy, you know, that's, you know, for the sake of the Republican Party and the sake of our country, you know, I hope we don't have a president that is simply elected with one demographic constituency.
But did you see anything last night that would suggest to you that there's a significant outreach going on?
No.
No. Paul Manafort, who's running the campaign, told a group of reporters that they're modeling it out. And I had sort of tweeted about this before he said it because it looked familiar to me, the Law and Order campaign, that they're running the Nixon 68 campaign. But I don't know where exactly the demographics were then, but whites were probably...
A much larger percentage
of
the population.
Well, you know, upwards of 90% probably.
Yeah.
I mean, voting population.
Yeah.
I mean, so, you know, that's a kind of flawed
calculus. Well, it would mean necessarily having to bring in a ton of voters, of white voters, who haven't voted before.
Right.
And registering and signing up, but...
Which requires an organization that they don't really have.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's the narrowest of paths.
You know, Mitt Romney got 59% of the white vote in 2012, and that was the most anybody had gotten since George H.W.
I know,
Bush.
It's amazing.
And he got 206 electoral votes.
Right.
Now, Donald Trump may get more than 59%, although in that same poll, he was not close. I mean, Hillary was getting 37%. I think Obama got 39% of the white vote in 2012. So I'm just trying to figure out where this thing is going. You know, it's one thing to win a nomination within the Republican Party. You know, I just don't know where the, as you say, where the math adds up.
Yeah, I mean, so far everything seems to be aimed at the base. I mean, last night was very much base messaging. And
what would you advise him?
Well, I just say there's got to be a compassionate component to the conservative message. And, part of Trump's success is that he's kind of post-political in a way that he's not sort of a typical Republican.
Well, he revels in it. I mean, he flays political correctness.
Yeah. And so that is in some ways a huge opportunity to have a much more expansive message. And, the convention's a time to take advantage of that and use that opportunity. So he's got 3 days left. I hope he does it.
Yeah, you know, conventions, I think, are underrated. They're really pretty important. That's where you really lay down your narrative, and it's a pure...
With the exception of the debates, I think it's the most opportunistic moment to grow your support and for people to show who you are and what you are. I mean, it's really 4 days that you own. You get to control. And unless you invite Clint Eastwood or plagiarize a speech, you should be able to...
Well, let's talk about that. You know, Melania Trump was featured. This was going to be the big moment of the night. There were a couple of... Even before the fact that she... that the speech included plagiarized sentences from Michelle Obama's speech. The thing that struck me was that the speech was strangely sort of detached. She said she used a lot of words that they need to use about different groups and about compassion and children and so on. But there was nothing very revealing about Donald Trump, which is usually what you hope the spouse, the family member will do. It contributes to this notion that he is a character behind which no one knows.
Yeah, and I think that was in some ways a missed opportunity. I mean, this goes back to the notion of authenticity and vulnerability. She's somebody who could testify beyond the things that we already know about Donald Trump, right? And then we could talk about a Sunday afternoon and with the papers and or small acts of kindness or generosity. And, it was in some... I mean, I thought it was a perfectly acceptable speech, and I think she kind of cleared the bar of expectations, but I think that there were some missed opportunities there as well.
All right, what about the plagiarism?
Well, the feature of the Trump campaign that they have consistently been telling everybody is an asset, which is they are a small, nimble unit that doesn't require layers of bureaucracy and thousands of staffers, they're getting payback for that because when you do a national speech on television, the one absolute obligation and responsibility the campaign has is to vet that speech. And standard speech vetting 101 means you run it through the speech software.
Well,
they
said they've been working on it for 5 weeks.
Well, they should have worked on it for 6 weeks.
The thing that struck me last night was when we've both been involved in convention planning, that's another form of storytelling, and you want to carefully consider how each piece fits together, and each piece needs to build or add something new.
Yeah.
What we heard last night was a lot of repetition, a lot of Benghazi, just over and over again. She was like a pleasing presence in a white, angry white man sandwich between Rudy Giuliani and General Flynn.
Yeah, she kind of told more of the immigrant story and kind of raised some of that.
I just think the whole construction of that 10 o'clock hour, which is the most important hour when everyone... Pattern. That's where you get your swing voters.
Yeah,
when the
and what you're saying is there should have been a narrative architecture to that hour. And instead
yes.
they were like flipping people and there was
you've
lost your like superstar... Joni Ernst, and
exactly.
she didn't even make prime time. But that's one of the interesting things about the...
Another reflection, by the way, I think, of lack of infrastructure and organization and planning.
Yeah, exactly. I think we can both appreciate those notions that, we're rolling out, the potential first lady, Melania Trump, and those initial stories about how much they'd worked on it, And oh, and yes, and she's writing it herself.
Yes.
Well, that story's changing a lot, isn't it? It's like that.
Yes.
Well, actually, there were other people involved.
Yeah, yeah. How? What is the lasting, if at all, impact of this, other than sort of spoiling their first day?
Well, that's a big impact, though. I mean, as you said, this is a 4-day window of opportunity, and they just erased one of them. You know, they just took one day and threw it out the window in terms of controlling their message, and it's spiraled completely out of control. And they're going to spend most of the day trying to put out that fire. So I think it's going to, it's probably a 2-day fire.
Now I've I watch you religiously, and I've seen you talk about the Pence pick, and you like it. You think that it was a good pick.
I do. I think you think about what Donald Trump needs to do, and he needs to expand the coalition, expand his support, and of the sort of people he was looking at. I just thought people were saying, oh yeah, he should, like Joe Scarborough, was saying, he should pick Newt, or I think he was a big fan of Christie, just saying, that's his, maverick outsider message, and he should double down on that. Well, I think all those maverick double down voters are already for Trump. It's the people who are like, well, I'm kind of interested in Trump, but I'd like to know that there's an adult in the room with a pause button, like Mike Pence. So I thought in that sense he was.
I mean, the question is, are you expanding beyond your what is the natural Republican base?
Well, that's
does
true.
Pence help you?
I just remember how this process starts and how excited George Bush was, and as I know Trump was, and I'm sure Obama was at the beginning. You're like, God, I get to pick a vice president, and you have this like universe of people and great talents and famous people, and then you get kind of down to the lick log, as we say in Texas, and suddenly you're left with very few candidates.
Although with Trump it's different, because the truth is George Bush could have chosen from anybody. Barack Obama could have chosen from anybody.
You're right.
Not a lot of people wanted to be.
No, a lot of people took themselves
off
the list.
Which speaks to the bigger problem. Your guy isn't here. Bush isn't here. His dad isn't here.
You know, the one person who I thought was
Jeb Bush isn't here.
The perfect pick for him, and also oddly in this weird post-partisan notion, I had a candidate who would have been the perfect vice presidential pick for both him and Hillary Clinton, which was Condi Rice.
Yeah.
But I heard that he actually reached out to her a couple of weeks ago, and of course she said no.
Yeah. Yeah. What does it say that so many people don't want to be on the ticket with him?
I think it kind of speaks for itself.
I know, but this is a podcast, so things can't speak for themselves. You have to speak for them.
Okay. Oh, it's radio. Okay. The Republican establishment, the Donald Trump has run to a large degree against the Republican establishment. So the Republican establishment is not here. And, if your notion is you're going to win this election by energizing the base, you better make sure all the base is included, and the Republican establishment is a big part of the base.
But wasn't Pence sort of an offering to the Republican establishment?
Yeah, not to the establishment so much as it was to the conservative base, I think. Yeah.
And the House Republicans.
Yeah.
So what happens to the Republican Party in your view after this? You're a guy who's been sort of, you've been working this no labels thing.
Yeah. Well, I've also been saying for a long time that we need to blow up the Republican Party and start over, and that appears to be happening, at the very least. My concern is that there's no clear, coherent, compelling vision for the Republican Party going forward. And, I don't know where the compassionate conservative is or somebody with a compelling message. And Donald Trump has, it's unclear, hopefully we'll see over the course of the week, what that unifying vision, his vision is for the party. But it includes a lot of ideas that are pretty, one of the things that drew me to the Republican Party in the first place was, pretty radical free trade.
Yeah, you mentioned that earlier.
Free trader. Well, Donald Trump is not a free trader.
Right.
So that's going to, that's going to turn off some members of the coalition.
There are
it's going to bring in white, blue collar voters from the Rust Belt who have been hurt by trade. So, he's building a different kind of coalition, and everything we've thought about this election has been wrong. So, who knows? It's going to be, we can't base it on historical precedent.
But it is good TV, and you are right in the thick of it because you created this show called The Circus on Showtime. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, ironically, when we first thought of the name of The Circus, initially we thought, oh, that's a little over the top. And now we're looking at this.
I don't think so, my friend.
I don't think so. The initial idea for this, David, was I started thinking about it about 10 years ago, which and the rationale for the thinking was simply that we've been in a lot of campaigns. We find them to be interesting, fascinating ecosystems of players and characters and drama, 95% of which the public never sees. And I just thought, wouldn't it be fascinating if we could show the humanity behind these campaigns? It's just there's just great, interesting, dramatic stuff that goes on. And so the idea was, and by the way, not just to show it, but to show it in real time. That was, you know, you can, there are documentaries that are done after elections. And by the way, the Mitt documentary was in part an inspiration because I saw that and a lot of people saw it and said, well, where was that guy in the election? I mean, he was a really compelling, interesting guy. And I said, let's do this, roll it up real time so people feel like they can see what it feels like to be in a campaign, but also as it's happening, because that creates some drama because we don't know the end of the story.
You've gotten some extraordinary access, which I'm sure makes a lot of people jealous. But with that access, have you seen moments with a Trump, with a Hillary, that surprised you?
They all surprised me in some way. And that's the great thing about doing documentary filmmaking in politics is that we can see a much more contextualized version. If you just watch the news or watch the debates, you kind of get a very one-dimensional sense of these people. But if you can spend any time around them when they're off the stage and see how they interact with family, see how they treat staff, those are the kind of things that really give you a much greater
dimension. And what have you seen of those two?
Well, for example, Donald Trump is, you know, he really has a family dynamic that's compelling. And you meet his kids. For example, Donald Trump Jr. is one of the most interesting people I've talked to during the whole show. I met him in Elko, Nevada, in the middle of nowhere. And it was his first time that he'd gone out
Northern Nevada.
Surrogate for his father. And it was one of the most interesting conversations that I've had with anybody this whole election. He was just authentic, compelling, interesting, you know, candid. And
well, we'll have a chance to see him in the next few days.
Yeah, and so. I think he'll surprise a lot of people. He's just he's an interesting.
Well, I know Ivanka. I've actually sat next to her at a dinner, and I would say the same about her. In fact, I called Donald Trump. I have to confess, after having dinner with her, and I said, "Well, it must be the mother, because it can't be you."
Well, you know, you look
which,
at,
by the way, he took very well.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, you look at people's kids, and you know, you say, "Well, something's going on right there." You
right.
Know, I mean,
well,
you,
I think
you
that's
don't
what
raise
they
great
hope.
Kids like that by accident.
That's
you know?
What about Hillary?
You know, I had the opportunity to kind of intersect with her on some nonprofit work over the last few years, and you know, I've been really struck in the times that I've seen her too, on the trail, kind of when the cameras are off, that she's. It's just surprising.
Classic thing, huh?
Yeah, you know, where she's got a sense of humor.
Yeah.
You know, she's got a very warm side to her, and very engaging and thoughtful, and you know, engages and listens. So, I mean,
serious about stuff.
Yeah, serious about stuff, but serious about stuff in a good way.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. No.
I mean, the thing
that
I come away from the interactions that I've had, kind of on a staffing level too, is that you know, whatever you may think about Hillary Clinton's politics, this is one competent person.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she is highly competent and, you know, and a good manager. So, you know, if you want somebody in Washington kind of knows where the levers are, this woman knows where the levers
are.
Well,
and that's, I think, going to be the contrast in November, which is do people choose reliability, competence, stability, or do they want something that, do they want to blow the thing up? And so it becomes, you know, temperament versus, you know, the same old, trustworthiness. I mean, that's the construct that's being set up here in a very volatile world. It's a interesting. It will make for great television. Sunday nights on
Sunday
Showtime.
Nights at 8 o'clock Showtime. And if you don't have it in your cable package, you can get it on an app on your device.
Mark McKinnon, thanks for your friendship, for all the good counsel you've given
me.
Hey,
let me just say this: I've known a lot of interesting characters and people in this business. David Axelrod is one of the finest, and if I were running for office, you're the guy that I'd want on board, not as a not just as a consultant or professional, but as a friend.
Well, I can say if you run for office, I'll come out of retirement with full confidence that you never will.
Well, you can have full confidence that if I run for anything, it'll be the border.
Thanks for being here.
Hey, man, take it hard.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, part of the CNN Podcast Network. For more episodes of The Axe Files, visit cnn.com/podcast and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite app. And for more programming from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.